Often vulgar, always explicit, and sometimes funny.
Slap box. Slap box.
Welcome to the Slapbox Podcast. This is episode 423. I am your host, Josh Albrecht, and I am once again inside the Slapbox Bunker. Hello, hello, hello. I've been watching some old Tom and Jerry. Actually, a coworker of mine, Cameron. Not Cameron that has been on the show. This is completely unrelated. Cameron. He informed me of he has, I guess, a DVD, I suppose, of the Tom and Jerry, and I hadn't watched Tom and Jerry in a long time. Now, I'm sure most people are probably familiar with the Tom and Jerry. That is the cartoon of the Tom and Jerry, that Tom is the cat, and of course Jerry is the mouse. It is originally a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, and it started, I believe, in the 40s. I'll look that up. But they would go on to like make movies and such too. But the original cartoon would end, I believe, in 56, if I read that correctly. The original run of the or 57, around that time, the shorts had started 1940, I suppose. Looking at that, and so I had heard that he had this DVD, and he watched like all of the Tom and Jerry on there, the original run, I suppose, not the movies and all that shit. But he said the last four episodes are really fucking dark for a kid's cartoon. And I guess I had never seen this. Apparently, I guess they didn't really run this on the air much. But the last episode, pretty dark. And so I pulled it up and I watched it today. He told me about this yesterday. So I had watched it. Well, I guess I'd watched it yet some last night and watched more of it. I'll just go ahead and play some of it and you can hear some of the audio as I kind of commentate on it here. This is from the final episode of the original run of Tom and Jerry. From the episode is called Blue Cat Blues. It is some dark shit. Hold on. Tom is sitting on a railroad track on a bridge right now. Jerry's above him, looking down. Tom. Jerry's talking.
In a few minutes, it'll all be over. And for the first time since he met her, he'll be happy.
You can hear the train coming as his just
poor,
his eyes are
miserable,
bloodshot.
Lovesick creature. I suppose people will say
ready
I
to die.
Have helped him. I know. But it's better this way. I'll never forget that first morning when it all started. If ever there were two true friends.
Just clowning around. Drinking some lemonade. Tom sucks Jerry through a straw. Wipes him off, though, because he's a good bud. He's a good bud, because that's what cats and mice are like.
She
good friends.
By.
There's a...
When Tom first saw her, I thought he'd flip his lid.
It's a white cat coming by. Tom's tongue is just hanging out. It's full hang.
At the very beginning, there was a strong magnetic attraction between them.
She doesn't seem to notice Tom at all.
I tried to stop it, but it was no use.
There's a
poor simple Tom. He was putty in her hands.
She's making shapes out of Tom's face right now.
I've never seen him so happy or so much in love.
Yeah, smashes himself against the wall. Now, like, here's
but
where
Tom
the
had arrived.
Other male cat comes into
Mr.
play here.
Butch.
Smoking a cigarette. money sign appears. The smoke. Oh man, he's a Mr. Rapist. He just grabs the cat and just starts making out with her. She seems halfway willing? Oh, that's the end of this clip. I gotta go back to the, go to part two here. This is, Skip has the part. He brought her flowers, and they just fall apart, and some perfume. Very small about her little perfume, whereas Butch, the other love interest, brings a whole truck of perfume. It's actually not perfume. It'd still be perfume. Let's get every cent out of his sock here. He's got a diamond, what appears to be a diamond ring, but she has to use a magnifying glass, of course, to see it. I mean, this thing is so small, of course. Who wastes his whole life savings on it. Now she's putting welding masks on her and Tom before she unveils this massive diamond ring that Butch got her. As it's blinding them.
Jewelry failed to impress her, he signed away his life to buy a car. 312 monthly payments at 112% interest. It cost him an arm and a leg. But
he signed an arm and a leg off.
He sold himself into slavery.
Some dark shit. This is a shitty fucking car too. And you can hear it backfiring, and she's not impressed. She gets ran over by Butch in this massively long vehicle. She just gets in and just like, yep, done.
After that.
Oh, this is great. This is where he becomes
He started drinking.
It appears that he's drinking milk, but, I mean, he's looking awfully drunk for just milk. It's probably White Russians. He's just pounding them back. There's empty bottles everywhere.
The next step was the gutter.
He's just going down the drain, literally. He's in the gutter, in water. Jerry appears to be given a resuscitation, getting the water out of his lungs. So we see Butch that just got married.
Story.
As he's driving by.
The story of a cat with a broken
white cat,
heart.
As Tom is sitting on the train tracks waiting for the
Too
train to come.
Everybody doesn't have a girl like mine. A girl that loves me and only.
Apparently Jerry has got it bad for this mouse.
Bit of a true blue. Ever-loving heart.
As she drives, this mouse drives by in some other male mouse's cars. It says just married. Now they're both sitting on the train tracks. As you can hear the train coming, they're waiting to get... One would assume that Tom and Jerry are dead at the end of that. I mean, they are not moving. They are fucking suicide. It's like, damn right, we are done with life. These women have fucking turned us into horrible beings. We don't care anymore because I can't get the lady. And it's just time to sit on the train tracks. That is some totally dark shit for a fucking cartoon. That is fucking great. I remember enjoying, when I was young, like Tom and Jerry. But I don't remember it getting that bleak. I feel like I didn't see that episode is from what I've read, they did not refuse from airing that again. And there was a let's see what Wikipedia has to say. I mean, that is some dark shit. And but it's still got the charm of Tom and Jerry. There's the cartoonish shit, Tom sucking Jerry through the straw, and Tom runs into a wall and falls to pieces. Blue Cat Blues on Wikipedia here says it's a 1956 one-reel animated Tom and Jerry cartoon and was written, directed, and produced by co-creators William Hanna and Joseph Barbera. Short was released by MGM on November 16th, 1956 in CinemaScope. Produced in the Western Electric Sound System. Unusually for a Tom and Jerry cartoon, Jerry speaks lengthy lines through an inner monologue. But, I don't have to go over the plot. I want to know about the reception here. That's what I'm looking for in the legacy. Critical response in Cartoon Carnival, a critical guide to best cartoons. Writer Michael Sammerdyke said, Blue Cat Blues is deeply indebted to Tex Avery for its gags video movie guide 1995 called The Short Interview of the aforementioned Festival of Fun. VHS said, among the worst Tom and Jerry outings. That's it. You can't have more into this. This is a legacy. The short is often considered the darkest Tom and Jerry cartoon due to its subject matter and ending. Additionally, it is often confused to be the final short of the series. This is untrue. However, the final short produced by the MGM was Tot Watchers. And the final short overall was Per Chance to Dream. So, yeah, I guess it's not the official last episode. So one would assume they didn't kill themselves. But, you know, maybe those are prequels. And you definitely get the idea that they're going to get hit by a train and die. But, I mean, it is a cartoon, so maybe that they'll just get flattened and be okay. Because that's how shit works in cartoons. Let's see what terrible TV shows MiraHayes.org has to say about Blue Cat Blues. There's a and just give me a this is redeemed. Yeah, okay, let's hear some trivia on it on the terrible shows.MiraHayes.org. This is the first cartoon where we hear Jerry speak through. Yeah. To the last scene of the short, which is, it is implied that Tom and Jerry decided to commit suicide by waiting for a train to run over them and killing them. An internet creepypasta was created stating that Blue Cat Blues was the final Tom and Jerry animated short. But that's not the case. Since Jerry Mouse is telling the story of Blue Cat Blues through inner monologue, the short does not break the cardinal rule of Tom and Jerry physically speaking in their cartoons. The score of this cartoon was featured on the audio CD Tom and Jerry and Tex Avery 2. Yeah, okay. There is a... This is... I want to find out about how it was received. I want to say reaction. Like, I want to know, like, the original reaction, like, when this aired. But this is all just like, did Tom and Jerry commit suicide? Obviously, in that episode, they did imply... I mean, it was clear. They did. Whether or not, you know... I wonder who decided on doing that one on the show. That's pretty fantastic. Let's see here. I've got, I want to know, but I still don't see, like, the original reaction. All this is, of course, reactions of now. And people spreading the Tom and Jerry tried to kill themselves. Anyway, I guess I'll just flip over to the warpedfactor.com's got 10 things you might not know about Tom and Jerry. This is interesting. Number one. In June 1937, animator and storyman Joseph Barbera began to work for the Ising Animation Unit at MGM, then the largest studio in Hollywood. He learned that co-owner Louis B. Mayer wished to boost the animation department by encouraging the artist to develop some new cartoon characters following the lack of success with its earlier cartoon series based on the Captain and Kids comic strip. Barbera then teamed with fellow Ising unit animator and director William Hanna and pitched new ideas. Among them was the concept of two equal characters who were always in conflict with each other, and an early thought involved a fox and a dog before they settled on a cat and mouse. The pair discussed their ideas with producer Fred Quimby, then the head of the short film department, who, despite a lack of interest in it, gave them the green light to produce one cartoon short. Number two, here's the resulting short, Puss Gets the Boot, was released on February 10th, 1940. I love the name, Puss Gets the Boot. It features a cat named Jasper and an unnamed mouse named Jinx in pre-production and an African-American housemaid named Mammy Two Shoes. Different times, people, different times. It was, Mammy. All right. Hanna and Barbera, having been advised by management not to produce any more cat and mouse films focused on other cartoons, matters changed, however, when Texas businesswoman Bessa Short sent a letter to MGM asking whether more cat and mouse shorts would be produced as Puss, Puss Gets the Boot was proving popular at her movie theater. This helped convince MGM to commission a series. Number three here is a studio contest held to rename both cartoon characters was won by animator John Carr, who suggested Tom the Cat and Jerry the Mouse after the Christmas time drink. Really? Carr was awarded a first place prize of $50. Tom and Jerry was, though, a commonplace phrase for youngsters indulging in riotous behavior in 19th century London. The term comes from Life in London, or Days and Nights of Jerry Hawthorne and His Elegant Friend Corinthian Tom by Pierce Egan. However, if Carr was aware of this, it's not thought that there was any more than an unconscious knowledge when naming the characters. Number four here, as well as entertaining audiences, Puss Gets the Boot was a critical success, earning an Academy Award nomination for Best Short Subject Cartoons in 1941, despite the credits listing Ising and omitting Hanna and Barbera. Ooh. After MGM gave the green light for Hanna and Barbera to continue the studio interproduction on the second Tom and Jerry cartoon, The Midnight Snack, the pair continued to work on the series for the next 15 years of their career, producing a staggering 114 episodes. Throughout all their run and all subsequent versions of Tom and Jerry, the original short, Puss Gets the Boot, is the longest episode of Tom and Jerry with a runtime of 9 minutes and 8 seconds, where they have a shot of Mammy, and she is clearly a black stereotype of a Mammy. There's not much more to say about that. Number six here is the cartoon violence depicted in Tom and Jerry has often been surrounded with controversy, but perhaps the most controversial aspect, or rather character, was Mammy Two Shoes. She was the owner of Tom in the series and was mostly known by her legs rather than by her face. In the entire run of Tom and Jerry cartoons, her face was shown only once, very briefly, in the episode named Saturday Evening Puss, released on January 14th, 1950. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen this. I don't remember Mammy so much. I guess you would only see mostly her legs in this show. Some years later in the 60s, when Tom and Jerry first began being broadcast on television, Mammy Two Shoes proved to be a very controversial element of the series, as she was depicted as a poor black maid who speaks in a stereotypical black accent. This was seen as being far too sensitive for broadcasters at a time when race relations were rarely out of the news. She was removed from the TV version simply by pasting over the scenes featuring her with new scenes. Most of the time, she was replaced with the similarly fat white Irish woman. Occasionally, as in Saturday Evening Puss, a thin white teenager took her place instead. Then later, Mammy Two Shoes was reinstated in the cartoons, but her voice dubbed to make her sound less stereotypical. Then seven here. Another controversy surrounding the 1956 episode. Here we go. Blue Cat Blues. In it, Tom and Jerry apparently commit suicide. The duo are both heartbroken, having lost their respective loves. Tom, also penniless and depressed, sits on the railway tracks waiting for the oncoming train. Jerry joins him, of course, as the train whistle grows louder. As the train approaches, the cartoon fades to white. Number 8, during the Hanna-Barbera years, 13 Tom and Jerry shorts were nominated for an Academy Award for Best Short Subject, and even went on to win, breaking the winning streak held by Walt Disney Studio in the category. In total, Tom and Jerry have won more Academy Awards than any other character-based theatrical animated series. That's impressive. Number 9, in 1961, MGM revived the Tom and Jerry franchise and contracted European animation studio Rembrandt Films to produce 13 Tom and Jerry shorts in Prague, Czechoslovakia. All were directed by Gene Deitch, who also wrote most of the cartoons and produced by William L. Schneider. Deitch stated that he was not a fan of the Tom and Jerry cartoons, thinking they were needlessly violent. However, after being assigned to work on the series, he quickly realized that nobody took the violence seriously. It was merely a parody of exaggerated human emotions. He also came to see what he perceived as the biblical roots in Tom and Jerry's conflict, similar to David and Goliath, stating that that's where we feel a connection to these cartoons. The little guy can win, or at least survive to fight another day. Deitch's shorts were commercial successes, with the first released on September 7th of 61 and the last on December 21st, 62. During this time, the Tom and Jerry series became the highest grossing animated short film series of 61 and 62, dethroning Looney Tunes, which had held the position for 16 years. But in retrospect, the Deitch era is one that many fans feel to be the weakest run of Tom and Jerry cartoons. And finally, we come across number 10 here. After the last of the Deitch cartoons were released, Chuck Jones, with partner Les Goldman, went on to produce 34 more Tom and Jerry shorts, beginning in 1963. All of these carry Jones' distinctive style, the slight psychedelic influence, and a memorable opening theme in which Tom replaces the MGM lion, then is trapped inside the O of his name. Though Jones' shorts were generally considered an improvement over Deitch's, they nevertheless had varying degrees of critical success. MGM ceased production of Tom and Jerry shorts with the final and 161st theatrical short, Per Chance to Dream, released on September 8th, 1967. So, I believe it does look like that Blue Cat Blues was, I guess, the last of the Hanna-Barbera, though. If I'm following that correctly. Maybe I'm wrong. But damn, that is some totally dark shit. That is just, here you go, kids. Your beloved friends, Tom and Jerry, are going to kill themselves because women are evil. That's what I get from that. Or at least certain women. It does really seem like, don't go for the hot women. And meanwhile, they probably had like this not as attractive friend that was like always around, just like loving Tom and Jerry and wanted to be with them. But they're like, no, I'm with this hot girl that's going to ruin me and make me commit suicide. So, you know, they didn't have that part in there, though. It's just, no, they just fall for the hot girl. When in reality, she just, you know, stayed buds, you know, and just hung out. They'd have been fine. But no. No, they're going to kill themselves together. They're going to Thelma and Louise it, sort of. Sort of not really. I don't think when Thelma and Louise rode off the cliff that it was out of heartbreak. But they were victimized, I believe. And then they went on a... you know, it's been a long time since I watched Thelma and Louise. I don't remember quite the plot of it. I remember them killing themselves in the end. As they drove off a cliff. Spoiler alert! Speaking of women and such, there's I guess in light of seeing the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I might have started this last week. I don't believe I did though, but I started watching Handmaid's Tale, and I kind of wanted to watch it before, but it does seem with the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, maybe this is the way things are going, you know. That women are just going to lose their rights, and that we're going to have basically the Al-Qaeda takeover, and women are going to be wearing burqas here, which is, you know, kind of what happens in Handmaid's Tale, if you're unfamiliar with actually watching the show. It's a good show. I've watched the first season, and I haven't gotten the other seasons. I don't know if I'm going to. If I do, I might just pay for Hulu for like a month and like binge the other couple of seasons and then hopefully get rid of it, because I can't afford it right now. But man, the first season is really good. Again, the premise of it is, I guess for some reason in the future, well, I guess it's supposed to be like present day, but because the environment is going to shit and somehow this is affecting reproduction with women, and that most babies die. And there's this extremist religious group in America that seems almost like the Westboro Baptist group, the Fred Phelps thing, the God Hates Fags people, if you're familiar with that. Like, because this extremely extremist group is against homosexuals and stuff, calls them gender traitors. And there is, I believe, some signs in there where it does say, like, God hates fags. But I'm sure that was inspired. The original, there was a movie, and I guess it was started from a book, The Handmaid's Tale, but there was a movie in, like, the early 90s, The Handmaid's Tale. I have not watched the movie. It had several big people in it, though. There was a... Yeah, anyway, so the this group is they've decided to take over America, and Sons of I don't remember what the group is. This anyway, they take over somehow, and you don't know exactly when you first start watching. You get pieces as the first season progresses of what exactly transpired in order for them to take over in the whole US. And anywho, they take over, and just make it to where nobody can escape. As I'm not sure where the regions are of Gilead is now the U.S. It's considered Gilead, or at least most of the U.S. There's parts that I guess there was a war, as I assume in the later seasons you get a little bit more peek of what went down with the war. You don't really see that in the first season so much, but they this religious group takes over and forms Gilead, and they snatch up all the women, and they want the ones that have given birth already, that they know can do so, because again all the children are dying, and one is to assume, by the way it's played out in the season, watching the TV series, is that it's because of the shitty way we've treated the planet and the environment's doing this. And, of course, the handmaids, what their job is, they have the commanders of this, of Gilead, or the upper echelon of Gilead. And they, I guess, each one of them gets a handmaid, and they try, and they rape them to impregnate them as to carry on Gilead so they can keep having children. And, it's a pretty dark shit. They have what they call the ceremony, where they lay down. They the handmaid comes in with the wife of the commander, as it's just those two in their bedroom, where the handmaid will lay her head down on the lap of the commander's wife, where the commander then enters the room while the wife is holding the wrists of the handmaiden to ensure, I guess, that she stays down while she gets raped. And, it's pretty dark shit. It's pretty dark shit. But, when I thought, really not looking into it a whole lot, I was like, oh, yeah, this is totally where we're going. But then I realized that the right-wing extremist group is all about saving the environment. That was one of the biggest reasons for, starting this war and creating Gilead was the whole environmental part. And I was like, well, this is fiction. Not going to happen. Not going to happen. It's a good show, though. There is, I guess the biggest name is probably Joseph Fiennes. He was, he's been in several movies. He's, Ralph Fiennes' brother. He was in the movie I've seen the most of his is, Enemy at the Gates, which is, quite a few years old now. It's got Jude Law and Rachel Weisz in it. And he's, I guess, one of the bigger, higher-up commanders, as he's the one mostly followed, at least in the first season. I think we might get more of a look into the other commanders in other following seasons. I think it might be on, season 4 now. They've had at least 3 seasons I know of. But it may be too dark to watch right now. People kind of don't want a look into the future. For some people. Some people it might just look like, ooh, this looks promising. Maybe we should think about this. I guess in future seasons, June, or Offred, the main protagonist of the show is June, and she that's her real name, but her name in Gilead, they forced her to change her name to Offred, and I guess she's like forced to wear a thing over her mouth later on. It's a good show, though. There's a only rated 4 stars on IMDb. There's also Yvonne Strahovski. I don't know how to pronounce her name. She was on Dexter and several other shows. And Samira Wiley, who was she plays Moira. She was Washington on Orange Is the New Black. I did like her on Orange Is the New Black, and spoiler alert, she dies in there. I don't know if she eventually dies in Handmaid's Tale, but I feel like there's a good chance. There's Elizabeth Moth is the main protagonist. She plays the main protagonist of June. I'm looking to see. Yeah, I guess there is already like season 4 maybe hasn't been released yet. I guess it hasn't. Maybe they already shown the first episode, because you can see the it says 2021 though, so I guess that was one of the things that was halted in production due to coronavirus. Yeah, so I've been watching some dark shit, so like Tom and Jerry killing themselves and Handmaid's Tale, where it's just kind of fucked up. And there's a part two where they a part on Handmaid's Tale where he takes them to a brothel. So, you know, they get to a brothel on season 1, yet Walking Dead, I have not seen a zombie brothel, or any brothel for that matter. I would think in an apocalyptic situation, there's going to be a lot of that. They're going to be, like, doing some Handmaid's Tale shit and, like, forcing people to do things, obviously, they don't want. I mean, there's some fucked up individuals that we have seen in The Walking Dead, as, like, Negan is, you know, pretty fucking great as far as, like, psychotic is concerned. And, there's, I guess he took people's wives, like, it was that whole thing, and made it his own wise, but it doesn't really get too involved in that, as the show goes, as I recall. But, like, man, he's definitely a fucked up individual, but I didn't remember there being any court type of, like, brothel situation. As, like, in Handmaid's Tale, they go to what they have, what they call Jezebels, and these are women that they couldn't reform and turn into handmaids, or, I forgot what the other women are called, but there's women that just, like, work at the houses of the, like, the commanders and such. They're called, like, Marthas or something of that nature. That they are barren, I suppose, but they're forced to, you know, clean, cook clean, do whatever. And I would imagine, too, they would probably be, have the possibility of being raped as well, because it seems like there's just nothing to protect these women. So, dark shit. On the brighter side of things, I did, oh shit, I'm looking at my notes here. Yeah, I did watch some other dark shit, too. I'll get to that here in a little bit, but I have, I get it this week, I guess. I guess it was this week, but I've been rocking the Scuf controller, the Scuf Impact controller. Yeah, which I think I got a Wednesday, yeah. It's pretty nice. I mean, it's expensive. It better be fucking nice. I'm just afraid I'm going to break it. Now, this controller is the more expensive PS4 controller that you can get. It's got the 4 paddles on the back. Now, the way the paddles work is there's 4 for all the front buttons, like on a PlayStation. That would be your triangle, X, circle, and square. You can change. I paid for all of the special features on this. I've got it set up for FPS games, because I'm trying to rock the Call of Duty again. And so I've got the hair triggers, and it's like all military grade grips on the backside. And they call it military grade or something of that nature, but it's like got a splattered look to it. And I want the green, orange, and there's black joysticks with like a copper buttons on it, and I think it looks fairly decent on the back. It's black with green splatters, and then But on these controllers too, I only have one set of joysticks, but you can actually swap out the joysticks pretty easily. They give you a little tool, and you can get different size and length joysticks. I went with the long because I really like long joysticks. I like long sticks. What can I say? Just love them. Like the long stick. I like to just rub my finger all across the tip of it and just push it down, get that click, and just spin it around until completion. You know what I'm saying? Anyway. So I've rocked a little bit of the Call of Duty. Now, I am not saying I am going pro. By far. I would... It didn't immediately go, oh shit, I am amazing at video games. But, I did immediately see like an improvement in my kill-death ratio on Call of Duty. A lot of it is on my original PS4 controllers, my regular ones. Those are all Sony-issued ones. And which, unfortunately, Sony doesn't have their own pro controller, whereas Xbox puts out like some more like professional controllers, and Sony for whatever reason doesn't do that. Esports is big; you'd think they'd want to do that. Anywho, my regular ones, the Sony ones, I have stick drift in each one, and I have the thought that maybe Control Freak, there's Control Freak things you can get that add an extension to your joystick. I'm looking if there's a lot of people having that issue. There's an article. Somebody's asking on Reddit, are Control Freak thumbsticks bad for your controller? Which I think they are, because I've had three fucking controllers that go through this, but one of them I didn't use Control Freaks on, I don't think. Yeah, so I did quit using the Control Freaks on there. But, man, it just sucks. Like, those things, like, shitty. But these, you can swap out the joysticks on the SCUF controller and put on different sizes. I only have the one size right now. I like the size and the length. I love the long. So I don't think I'll probably be getting any. The joysticks are fairly cheap compared to, like, the rest of the controller. I am not seeing. Reading what people have to say, they're saying, oh, it's probably you and your fingers that are causing the problems. Yeah, there's a. I guess I'm putting weird angles and shit on my sticks. That's why I get the stick drift. So you're saying I play games badly? That's like. Stick drift is horrible. There's some just shitty shit, yo. And I've looked up ways to fix the stick drift. Now, I haven't completely taken apart my controllers. I mean, I've got three controllers that have the problem. I might as well fucking take one of them apart and try to fix it. But the scuff, man. I'm digging the scuff. I haven't fully gotten used to using the paddles to do all my actions. Like doing the circle and the X, they're the outside paddles. I have an easier time doing those. But like the triangle and square, as of right now, I haven't set. I could switch it. But I have those set to the inner ones. And for some reason, on the one on the left side, the square, I have a harder time hitting that. But it is nice because you can use those and you don't have to pull your fingers off the joysticks as you're flying around just killing shit. So it's like, you know, you get more time to lock onto targets, annihilate, and all of that good shit. And I definitely have had more higher percentage kill-death ratio, where it's like more in the positive than in the negative, which is good. You want a positive KDR. You want to be alive more than dead. Fly just flew right into my microphone. That's some great audio right there. Fortunately, there's still a lot of those fuckers flying around here. They've gone down a little bit, but for some reason while I'm doing the podcast, it decided to come back out. That's not like a full-size fly. That's more like a gnat. But they're still like little fuckers. So yeah, I am looking forward to really rocking that scuff controller on the new Call of Duty Cold War, as that will be coming out November 13th. And unfortunately, I was just a few days shy, really, of getting it to play on the alpha, but at least I'll be able to use it on the beta. I've used it a little bit on my computer with AimLab, but it's not, I don't know, it's difficult to use the controller on AimLab. I'm not as fast with the mouse, so, as I am with the mouse. The mouse is quicker, but I guess I can screw around with the settings, the sensitivity settings in-game and make it quicker to use the joysticks. Which is, I suppose, I could do on Call of Duty. Maybe that would help me with my KDR as well. As I am long ways from being able to go pro. I'm no Dr. Disrespect. I'm not going to get millions of dollars to stream and play video games on the internets. That would be great if I could do that. If I can work that out somehow, that'd be fantastic. But I would recommend it. Like, you can get the more of the base models. Like, you can get, I spent way too much money on this thing. But, like, these Scuff Impact, I believe I want to say is, like, 150, 160 without changing anything on it. Now, you can customize the shit out of these controllers. And it gets pretty ridiculous. There's a... just look at it. You can go to, there's Impact. This is the one I've got. Now, the Impact you can use on PC and PS4, which all the controllers that Scuff sells, you can use on PC. But some you can only use on Xbox, some only on PlayStation 4. Now, the Impact is the one that I've gotten. It is, of course, the one with the four paddles. It starts at 150. So, I mean, already from the get-go, it's pretty pricey, but then you can put in all kinds of options as far as, like, button layouts and all kinds of shit you can do to these controllers, and it gets pretty crazy. And they also have, if you go to, I think, on their main page, discover, customize... there's a way to look at, they have, oh damn it, this fucking fly is killing me here. That's not it. They already have models that have been like kind of set up, and they have, I think they're set up as like, you can go to see pro players. No, that doesn't, I guess pro teams. Look at that. There's a way to where you can look at, they have specialty controllers you can get, like, okay, they have all the, there's the Call of Duty League 2020 collection, and they've got the FaZe and all the esports teams, they have their own specialty controllers, and I would imagine those are probably, those are start out at 170. As I didn't want to do that. I wanted to have kind of my own logo. But you can, of course, pop off the skin, from what I understand, and get another skin to replace it with. These are, I believe, fairly easy to customize. I haven't tried to take mine apart or anything, but it's definitely a good, cool thing. There's also the Pro, which the Pro only has the two pedals. Definitely. Now, the Pro, I think, is a little bit lighter, if you want a lighter feel. And, man, there's other... I know there's other other controllers on here with, like... more than just, like, the Pro teams. They have other, like, designs you can pick from. Anyway. if you got money to spend and you really want to up your game on some FPS games or just games in general, you know, Scuf, I'd give it a go. I have heard negative reviews that shit does go out on them early, but again, like I've said, I've had so much shit fucking problems with my normal PlayStation controllers. I was like, fuck it, I'm the new Call of Duty, I got on my PC. And I figured with this controller, since I can play it on PC or PS4, that I can like swap between the two fairly easily and give it a go, as it seems to be easily to do. You just plug it in with the USB cord, which is strange. I did not have one thing. It didn't come with one on the controller. I was surprised by that. Why the fuck didn't it come with a cable? You gotta buy that separately. That's fucking weird. You can get a lot of shit with it though. And there's cases you can get. There's everything's so fucking expensive though. Oh, there's a rest for your hands and shit that you can buy. Oh, this is interesting. It looks like a big controller. I didn't know what the hell it was. I thought it was a rest for your controller. But there's an exoscuff, as they call it, and it's for helping your back. So you put your... you have your arms and stuff in the right thing. I think the armrest of my chair work for that. I don't think I need this thing, but that's interesting. It's a big pillow you just put on your lap. Oh, and I guess it has air in it. You can change how much air it has in it. This is interesting. It's supposed to help with your alignment of your back, which maybe I do fucking need that, because I feel like maybe I don't sit in proper alignment, because I've had some issues with like my neck and shit. Maybe that has something to do with it. Now, shit, I better stop looking at this. I'm going to buy it. It's only $40. It's not ridiculously expensive for what it is, I guess. There's plenty of other accessories. There's not plenty of the player pack. There's lube in the player pack. It is like I guess you can get the thumbsticks aren't too bad. Too crazy expensive. Looks like it's for a two pack. It's like $10. There's grip liquid. You can like. Do people really have a problem with like sweating? I guess maybe if you're like pro player and you're playing for hours on a hand, maybe your hands get sweaty. I don't know. My hands don't really get sweaty. I don't know why I would need my controller already has kind of grip. There's quite a few different thumbsticks to choose from. And then they have the infinity ring and locks to lock the thumbsticks in. There's not a ridiculous amount of different things. You can get new paddles, which are good because it seemed like these paddles would easily snap. They don't seem to be very thick plastic. I am concerned that I am going to break one of the paddles. They got plenty of those. Anyway, so what? Another thing I was watching, I was going to get to. I was just watching before I started recording here. I watched Tom and Jerry immediately before watching this, but before that I was watching the Challenger thing on Netflix, the docuseries that's Challenger, The Final Flight, I believe is what it's called, and I recommend watching that. I haven't seen every episode. I was pretty young whenever that happened. I wasn't quite in school yet, I don't believe. I would have, this was 1985, so I'd have been 4 years old. My recollection of four is basically zero. At this point, I vaguely remember living in a trailer court. I don't think I went to kindergarten for another year yet, so, and I didn't go to preschool, so I wouldn't have been in school watching it on TV, and I don't know, I guess maybe we watched when it took off at home. I'm not real sure. My mom, I'd have to ask her about that, ask my mother. Watching that docuseries, man, it's It's rough. I just got to, of course, at the beginning of the series, they show the challenge. Spoiler alert, they show the Challenger exploding with the teacher and the whole crew dying. And then they get into the next few episodes, they dive into, you get some of the ideas of what caused it already. Like, there was problems with the O-ring in the in the rocket boosters. And they knew this was a problem for a long time, and cold weather exacerbated that, and they keep talking about that throughout. But you get to know, like, all the astronauts. They go over, like, every individual in there. They deep dive from, like, the pilot to the teacher, all of them, and, really makes you feel for them a little bit. And then they go back to, like, the day of the launch, where it's freezing fucking cold, which they knew already beyond the O-ring problem that doing a launch on a cold day is not a good idea. And nobody really thought that was a great idea in the past, but NASA was they had already scrubbed the flight a couple of times and were eager to just get this one going, and a lot of people just signed off on it. Is the way I perceived it by watching the documentary, at least. And man, the last episode, full episode I watched was the day of the launch, and then you get to see, like, the families and such of the astronauts as they are watching as the rocket takes off, and it just explodes right in front of them. Like, man, that's some hardcore shit. That is some bad stuff, and it's kind of like Peter Billingsley. He was in A Christmas Story. He was the little kid in A Christmas Story. He was actually there as he was part of some NASA fan club thing or something of that nature. And he was there. I believe that they had some kind of deal, I guess for PR, that he was, like, involved. And yeah. So you get to hear from him. It's weird. Like, when I first saw him, I was like, wait a minute, is that the fucking kid from Christmas Story? He looks like, and then it was like, oh, yep. They say his name, and, like, he's from A Christmas. No, like, oh, shit, yeah. It was weird to me. I hadn't really seen anything on the Challenger in a long time. It was it's an interesting doc. And it's the episode I started on next, but I didn't quite get far into. It talks about the controversy of them, you know, trying to hide the fact that they knew that this O-ring was a problem and that they shouldn't fly on such a cold day. I mean, all the astronauts, they had thought, like, oh, well, especially when they saw the icicles, they're like, oh, they're going to scrub the flight. They didn't think, like, oh, we're not going to fly. They, you know, it was supposed to rain one day, and they canceled it over that. And the rain didn't even end up happening whenever they were would have launched. And then they had to scrap the flight because, a bolt got stuck, and they had to, like, cut it off, and didn't do it in time. So, had, you know, they'd flown either one of those 2 days, they probably would have been all right. It probably wouldn't have burnt through the O-ring and exploded. So, like, luck was just not on their fucking side. And, yeah, it's a good watch, though. If, I mean, usually, like, docuseries in general, but if, like, just hearing about NASA stuff. I think they should have more NASA docs on Netflix. Like, get some Apollo 11 on there. You know, some more positive stuff. I'm thinking NASA would probably want some more positive things out there after this one. Maybe Apollo 13 when shit went bad, but they fixed it. Or, you know. Or they could get into Wernher von Braun, the Nazi that turned into the head of NASA and got us to the moon. And from all things I've read, sounds like he committed war crimes. You know, but you know, he turned things around. It was part of Operation Red Paperclip, I believe is what that was called, where we, the Allies, well, America, I believe, is the only one. There's a... Oh, it's all one word. There's a... there's their one red paperclip. No? Werner von Braun? Let's see. Werner von Braun. It was just paperclip. It wasn't red paperclip. Operation Paperclip. That's when we were going into Nazi Germany, when we were liberating Germany, I guess, if you wanted to call it that. Went in there and took all the German scientists we could find. And yeah, that Werner von Braun. And they actually took, fun fact, the first rockets we sent into space were modified V2 Nazi, German Nazi V2 rockets that were modified. And we sent them into space. But there was a fight between us and the Soviets to get the German scientists that were involved in the rocket program. As we won that battle. So I don't know how I feel about Werner von Braun. I mean, the fucker was a Nazi war criminal. Never had to pay for any of those crimes. The war criminal part came from he was ran V2 factories in Nazi Germany, and they had slave labor, and he was well aware of the conditions, and I believe made, you know, decisions that affected people as far as death and kinds of horrible shit that was going on in these factories. Is like SmithsonianMag.com actually has an article on it. Says the atomic bombs dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki may have put an end to World War II, but they weren't the only destructive weaponry developed during the war, from nerve and disease agents to the feared and coveted V1 and V2 rockets. Nazi scientists worked on an impressive arsenal as the war came to a close in 1945. Both American and Russian officials began scheming to get that technology for themselves. So it came to pass that 71 years ago today, 88, well, this article was in 2016, so it's longer than that. 88 Nazi scientists arrived in the U.S. and were promptly put to work for Uncle Sam. In the days and weeks after Germany surrendered, American troops combed the European countryside in search of hidden caches of weaponry to collect. They came across facets of the Nazi war machine that the top brass were shocked to see. Writer Annie Jacobson told NPR's All Things Considered in 2014. Jacobson wrote about both the mission and the scientists in her book Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. She said one example was they had no idea that Hitler had created this whole arsenal of nerve agents. They had no idea that Hitler was working on a bubonic plague weapon. Oh, man. That is really where Paperclip began, which was suddenly the Pentagon realizing, wait a minute, we need these weapons for ourselves. I did not know he made a bubonic plague weapon. I don't remember hearing that. I heard biological shit. I don't recall that one. Anyway, but just studying these weapons wasn't enough, and the U.S. military wasn't the only country eyeing Nazi scientists. Their one-time allies in the Soviet Union were doing the same thing. If the Soviets were going to press their former enemies into service, American military officials didn't want to be left behind. So good old Uncle Sam hatched a plan to bring 88 Nazi scientists captured during the fall of the Nazi Germany back to America and get them back on the job. Only this time, according to History.com, they were working for the U.S. under a project known as Operation Paperclip. While the military did what they could to whitewash the past of their prisoners of peace, as some of the scientists called themselves, many had serious skeletons in their closets. For example, Werner von Braun was not just the brains of the V2 rocket program, but had intimate knowledge of what was going on in the concentration camps. Von Braun himself handpicked people from horrific places, including Buchenwald concentration camp, to work the bone building his rockets, Jacobson tells NPR. Operation Paperclip was top secret at the time, and after all, the devices these men helped design killed many people throughout Europe, not to mention the deaths their government was responsible for on the battlefield and in the concentration camps. Even agents with the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigations with the U.S. government tasked with hunting down top Nazi officials who went on the lam after the war were unaware for decades of the extent to which government officials were collaborating with their quarry. Tom Harnden reported to the Telegraph in 2010. Then, while many of the men were brought to the U.S. under the program were undoubtedly instrumental in scientific advancements like the Apollo program, they were also supportive and responsible for some of the horrors experienced by victims of the Holocaust. Ugh. Operation Paperclip has certainly left a questionable legacy. Yeah, but without Wernher von Braun, do we get to space? Do we get to the moon? It's an interesting dilemma there, and quite the dark history there. You know, Nazi Germany, and I don't know when it came to light about Wernher von Braun and him being the head of that, and like what exactly he did in Germany, in the U.S. But I guess he was doing what every good German was doing. They were just following orders, right? And never question authority. Just go with the flow. That's how these things happen. Everybody just, they told me to do it, so I did it. There's nothing, a lot of bad shit happens that way. I'm thinking if this is going to be a shocker, but I don't have any other notes written down. I don't have anything else. I would definitely like to see some more NASA docs, some good ones. It was cool a couple of years ago, I had mentioned this, but I went to the Science Center and saw the Apollo 11 landing ship, whatever you want to call it, and saw Buzz Aldrin's helmet and gloves when he landed on the moon. We landed on the moon! Should have had that shot from Dumb and Dumber in the exhibit. That would have been great, where Jim Carrey's like excited because we landed on the moon. It's a good exhibit, though. I think that exhibit is now at the, I want to say it's the Smithsonian. They had, I guess, toured it around. It was at the St. Louis Science Center for a bit. But I want to believe at the Smithsonian they have more of a Apollo 11 thing. As you can see, all the gear that they have left behind. And interesting stuff. And they also didn't have Buzz Aldrin punching that guy. We're calling him a liar, landing on the moon. They should really have that on loop in this exhibit because, you know, that's just fantastic. And Buzz Aldrin's already an old fucking man. Everybody fucking decks that dude. And people go, oh, that's proof that he didn't really land on the moon. Which I'm thinking is bullshit. I mean, if somebody comes up to you and calls you a liar and says, like, you're number one, absolute number one, biggest achievement in life is a lie. That you've been lying about this the whole time. And just calls you a piece of shit over it. I'm thinking you might want to punch the guy. And this isn't the first time he'd heard that shit, but the guy gets right in his face and calls him a liar and horrible person, all that shit. I mean, don't fuck with Buzz Aldrin, dude. That's what you get. I think it proves that, Buzz Aldrin didn't like being called a liar. I think that's what that proves. Anywho. That's really all I've got. So, as always, that's a kid in a wheelchair, not a trash can.